Hello and welcome to Take As Directed podcast. I'm Steve Morrison, Senior Vice President and Director of the CSIS Global Health Policy Center. Today we're delighted to hear from Ki B. Park, an expert on public health in North Korea. Ki is one of my co-authors on the commentary published this past week, The Gathering Health Storm in North Korea, along with a number of other contributors. This commentary is under the umbrella of the newly launched CSIS Commission on Strengthening America's Health Security, and we intend to remain active and current on matters pertaining to health and the humanitarian situation in North Korea as this drama unfolds. Professor Ki is a Paul Farmer Global Surgery Scholar at Harvard Medical School and Director of North Korea Programs for the Korean American Medical Association. Ki joins us via phone today from Boston. Ki, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks, Steve.
Now, you've been involved in health in North Korea for many years, directing medical exchange programs and supporting capacity-building efforts with the Korean American Medical Association. Now, that's quite unusual. I think many Americans are not very familiar with the level of initiatives that have evolved over the last decade or more that do build these partnerships, these collaborations on the medical front between Americans and their counterparts in North Korea. Can you tell us a bit about the origin of this work and your own involvement in it?
Sure. So just a little word about Korean American Medical Association. We call it KAMA. It's a 20,000 member organization, obviously doctors in the U.S. of Korean heritage. And we do have an interest in medical issues in North Korea. And about 10 years ago, decided to reach out formally to the North Korean doctors. And we did that through the New York Channel. As you know, the North Koreans have a mission at the UN in New York City. We met with the diplomats at the mission, and we expressed our desire to engage with North Korean doctors. And this was in 2007. At that time, things were fairly flexible as far as travel to and from, and we were invited to Pyongyang in September of 2007, met with the physicians. We also invited a delegation of North Korean doctors to the U.S. They visited in April of 2008. That was the last time the North Korean doctors visited the U.S. We'd like to have them come back, hopefully. But our group, the Korean American doctors, have been visiting Pyongyang twice a year since 2007.
And what's been the main purpose of the visits?
So we engage with the North Korean Medical Association, and we partner with specialties. So I'm a neurosurgeon, so I was introduced to the neurosurgeons in North Korea. We have other specialties, and they were partnered with their corresponding specialties. And we primarily provide training and education, and we, in that regard, we partner with two institutions. One is the Pyongyang Medical College, which is their premier teaching institution, and the other one is the Pyongyang Red Cross Hospital.
I see. Okay, so you just recently traveled to North Korea under this auspices, and this, of course, comes in the midst of tightly controlled sanctions on travel by Americans. Back in September of last year, the State Department restricted travel to North Korea in response to the death of the University of Virginia student Otto Warmbier. And so permission for travel is granted only under very limited circumstances, such as for journalism or humanitarian work. Tell us a little bit, first of all, how difficult was it for you to gain permission, and why did you succeed? And then tell us about your trip and what you did and what you observed.
Right, Steve. As you mentioned, the travel ban went into effect September of last year, and so our November trip, our fall trip, was canceled. Our workaround for that was we brought North Korean doctors to a third country, and in this case, it was Cambodia. And we partnered with a Cambodian NGO hospital and provided training that way. And that's worked out pretty well. We did apply for the special validation passports, and we understood that there was a category for humanitarian assistance. And so we do perform surgery. So we packaged our application in that regard. We said we were going in for a humanitarian surgical mission. And the process took some time, but we were ultimately granted special validation passports.
And so how different was the environment this time around, given how much has changed in recent months?
Well, so you know the Inter-Korea Summit was on April 27th. Now, we did not plan our trip to be the 4 days later. But we landed in Pyongyang on May 1st, which was a Tuesday. And I tell you, it was a different experience, and I'll give you some examples. We were greeted with a person at the immigration, and so of course they saw our passport. It was from the U.S., and there was a little bit of banter. It was almost a light-hearted banter. Says, how did you get permission? Says, well, we were able to get it, and the gentleman smiled and said, this is great. So it started with that, and then once we were in the country, we saw all the press. The Nodong Shinmun, which is their daily newspaper, had just come out with all the pictures from the Inter-Korea Summit. The entire Panmunjom Declaration was published. And then there was the Pyongyang Times, which is the English version of the newspaper. And that also had all the pictures in multiple pages. And I had to ask the people that we were meeting in North Korea, so, what do you think about this? And it was interesting, some of the responses that we were getting. But predominantly, they had a very good understanding of what was happening. But one of the questions I asked was, your country has developed these nuclear weapons and missiles at a very steep cost to the society. And wouldn't it be a shame to give it all up now? At this point, what do you think? And the response was, no, we had never intended to use these weapons for attack. And we're happy to give these up as long as we're provided that we won't be attacked ourselves. And they really understood the issues.
And what were you able to pursue in your conversations vis-a-vis the medical and health sector?
Right. So there were a couple of things that we were trying to get done. One was we had a series of operations that we performed, our team did, at the Red Cross Hospital this time. The other issue was to meet with the Ministry of Public Health regarding the Global Fund's decision to end the grants to North Korea on tuberculosis and malaria programs. And then the last one was exploring the possibility of a institution-to-institution partnership between U.S. and North Korea in a form of a health medical exchange program.
Well, let's take those one by one. On the Global Fund, why don't you describe what the sentiment was in the March 2018 decision around ending the program?
Right. So Global Fund, which provides $4 billion a year of funding, they're not an implementer. They provide funding and they partner with organizations within each country where there's a burden of HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. And for TB and malaria, well, let's just talk about TB, tuberculosis. They provide the drugs, high-quality drugs that's purchased outside the country. And in North Korea, they've been operating there since around year 2000. And over the last 8 years, they've supported the program to the tune of over $100 million. And they've achieved some quite remarkable successes. Malaria has been, I think, reduced by 75%. And then TB, they have now over 100,000 patients in tuberculosis who have tuberculosis on treatment, free drugs that are provided. And they go through two organizations, UNICEF and WHO. And so this has been going on successfully from a financial standpoint. They have gotten on their report cards, grant report cards. Either they have met or exceeded expectations. And they announced on their webpage earlier this year, February actually, that they will be ending their grants. And this is met with an outcry from the global public health professionals and saying this is a gross malpractice in some ways, because you can't just stop drugs on these patients. When you stop the drugs, it creates a shortage of these drugs, and then there's rationing, and then you have a surge of the multi-drug resistant strains of TB, which costs over 100 times more to treat. So that we wanted to know what happened. So I spoke with the Vice Minister of Health of DPRK, Vice Minister Kim Hyung-hoon, specifically about the process of ending the grant, whether there was a proper due process and opportunities for remediation. And I was really surprised to hear that the Ministry of Public Health in North Korea was just as surprised as everybody else, including WHO and UNICEF. To my understanding, they were not provided with any kind of opportunities to address any deficiencies or concerns that Global Fund may have had in North Korea. So that was a big surprise. Now we're working to overturn or delay the decision by Global Fund at the board and the secretariat level.
Did you have a chance to speak with WHO or UNICEF personnel in North Korea when you were there?
Yes, I have spoken to the WHO personnel, and they are just as stunned by the decision. WHO, as you know, is a UN specialized agency, and their finances are just as transparent as UNICEF, and they have high levels of standards. So yeah, they were surprised as well. They've made multiple overtures since the announcement, along with UNICEF, to try to understand why the decision was made, and they were not met with any kind of willingness to negotiate or at least discuss this.
Well, this is an issue that we treat in the commentary that you joined with us, the Gathering Health Storm North Korea. It's part of a broader phenomenon, which is that with the imposition of three rounds of international sanctions in 2017, this became awfully draconian and exceptional, and I think it began to frighten not just Global Fund, but many actors about even the appearance of any impropriety, and it also called into question, I think, in a more aggressive way, the whole question of the accountability of programs in country. Another thing that we've mentioned in this commentary is that the pledging by donors towards the WHO and UNICEF programs and World Food Program have been tailing off very dramatically. So you have a tightening of your ability to operate internally and to satisfy the accountability demands of your own organization. You have a shortage of money, and you have all of this intensifying political pressure. It's a really quite unusual situation, I think, that we face here. And I'm glad that you've pursued this in your own overtures. You wrote a commentary in The Lancet that you published, an open letter in March, and following up in this way. There are exemptions. There are humanitarian exemptions in the sanctions. The question is whether they're truly operational today, given these extraordinary political pressures that are coming forward. What's your own feeling? Is it going to be possible to reaffirm the humanitarian sanctions, to convince donors to come forward with more funding, and to avoid the most extreme restrictions or interpretations of those sanctions?
So, yeah, Steve, you bring up this more broader question of the human rights of the people within North Korea, the vulnerable population. The UN Security Council clearly has a legal mechanism to impose economic sanctions. But they're also, as a UN body, the members of the Security Council are bound by the broad charter, which also protects the human rights, right to life, right to food and medication, and then also not subjected to cruel and inhumane treatment. And so here's what's happening with the UN system. The multilateral economic sanctions are, we know it's going to hurt the vulnerable population. The question is, when are the member states, how accountable are they? And I argue that the sanctions writers will place into the sanctions regime these humanitarian exemptions, so that kind of gets them off the hook. But it really doesn't, because you have to look at the outcomes, not the inputs. And the outcomes is what you see in Global Fund. What you see is a huge funding gap in the UN agencies' needs and priorities. In 2018, the UNDP, the resident coordinator, has requested $111 million. This is the budget for the programs that the UN specialized agencies, such as UNICEF, WHO, and World Food Program, need to run their active programs. Right now, to this date, I'm aware of only $11 million being pledged for this. Mm-hmm. This is, to me, unacceptable. You can see how this maximum pressure policies have spilled over into this humanitarian domain, and it hurts the ordinary people. And at some point, we need to push back and say, hey, we have to make sure that humanitarian assistance at least is ensured and facilitated and protected, and it's not happening.
Now, you mentioned that part of your purpose in visiting was to explore and develop some ideas around institution-to-institution collaboration or partnerships into the future. Tell us what that will look like. I assume that you've returned with your colleagues, and you're now developing a proposal of some kind as a result of your visit. Is that true?
Yes. So one of my colleagues here at Harvard Medical School is Dr. James Muller, and he was the author of the U.S.-Soviet Union Health Cooperation Agreement under Nixon in 1970s. So we said, why don't we try to approach this in a similar way? There's a possibility with the upcoming summit. What can we do to be of assistance and help maybe even build the be part of the confidence building measures? So we proposed a Harvard Medical School and Pyongyang Medical College partnership, and it has three components. One is a doctor-to-doctor exchange, which we've done this for 10 years, and then the other part's jointly organized educational conferences, and third is collaborative research. We think that all these components are not does not require any concessions from either countries, and it doesn't violate any of the current sanctions. So while I was there, we worked out the details. The North Korean side are very receptive and agreeable to the components that we've outlined. So we have the details worked out. We just want to see if this will somehow at some point the governments will use it as a way to build confidence.
So what's your next step, Key, in terms of moving this proposal forward? What needs to happen next?
Well, we clearly want to be heard and then be noticed by the powers to be who are preparing for the summits. I think the North Korean side, now they've heard from us. We've been talking to the North Korean mission at the New York. We have had multiple conversations with the State Department. We hope that it is noticed by the people high up. And we've also spoken to the South Korean side, who also mm-hmm. see this as a very good way to build confidence during the negotiations.
So the idea is you have the beginnings of something that shows mutual interest carrying this forward, and perhaps this can get some lift in the course of the upcoming talks.
Yeah, we think this is sort of a softball. It's low risk. It's high value. You can grow into something more substantial as far as humanitarian assistance is concerned. So yes, we like to see this picked up by at least at the government levels.
You know, one other thing that you might look at as you develop this concept is the prior experiences as we move towards research and development collaborations with the Soviet Union in the Glasnost period. You've got James Muller with you. We've had openings with the Cubans and with the Iranians at different times where collaborations around research and development have been seen as a confidence-building measure and something that could be defended against any external critics as something that was really had significant value into itself and didn't compromise any of these other broader issues. Well, thank you so much. Did you want to offer us any closing remarks in terms of your overall perspective and how that has evolved in this last period? Both, I mean, this is such a historic and quick-moving period right now, and you've been involved now for 10 years. How does this feel to you?
Well, you know, I got to go back to my roots, which is I'm Korean, and I've been involved with North Korean affairs since now almost 12 years. And I tell you, this time it feels really different. It really feels like something is going to really happen. I'm very hopeful, optimistic that there'll be sustained peace on the Korean Peninsula. And what that means, I mean, we're talking 1 million soldiers on the North Korean side and 500,000 soldiers on the South Korean side that could potentially be placed back into the workforce. And then the resources that will be that will not go into the military. For instance, in North Korea, they spend a third of their national budget on military. And that could be now opened up to release to do social programs. So I'm very optimistic, Steve.
Thank you, and congratulations on all you've been able to achieve in this rather remarkable, complicated period. And thank you for sharing this with us, Key, and for contributing to our commentary. Very grateful to you for everything that you've been doing now and reaching back now over the past decade.
Thank you, Steve.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us for today's episode of our Take As Directed podcast, featuring North Korea health expert Key B. Park. If you've not had a chance, please check out our commentary. Key is one of the co-authors of The Gathering Health Storm in North Korea. And catch up on our latest publications and upcoming events at the CSIS.org Global Health Policy Center program page. And as always, we invite you to subscribe to Take As Directed so that you never miss our latest episodes.